Job 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set, or who laid its cornerstone, while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, 'This far you may come and no further. Here is where your proud waves halt.' Have you ever given orders to the morning, or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light, and where does the darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born, you have lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain, and a path for the thunderstorm, to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens, when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, 'Here we are'? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labour pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied his ropes? I gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt flats as his habitat. He laughs at the commotion in the town. He does not hear a driver's shout. He ranges the hills for his pasture and searches for any green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will he stay by your manger at night? Can you hold him to the furrow with a harness? Will he till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on him for his great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to him? Can you trust him to bring in your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully. but they cannot compare with the pinions and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly, as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labour was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom, or give her a share of good sense. Yet, when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. Do you give the horse his strength, or clothe his neck with a flowing mane? Do you make him leap like a locust, striking terror with his proud snorting? He paws fiercely, rejoicing in his strength, and charges into the fray. He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts, aha. He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread his wings towards the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build his nest on high? He dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is his stronghold. From there he seeks out his food. His eyes detect it from afar. His young ones feast on blood. And where the slain are, there is he. The Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Then Job answered the Lord, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more.
We continue where we left off, at verse 6 of chapter 40. That's on page 540 at the front of the Bible. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. Look at the behemoth, which I made along with you, and which feeds on grass like an ox. What strength he has in his loins, what power in the muscles of his belly. His tail sways like a cedar, the sinews of his thighs are close-knit, his bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like rods of iron. He ranks first among the works of God, yet his maker can approach him with his sword. The hills bring him their produce, and all the wild animals play nearby. Under the lotus plant he lies, hidden among the reeds in the marsh. The lotuses conceal him in their shadow. The poplars by the stream surround him. When the river rages, he is not alarmed. He is secure though the Jordan should surge against his mouth. Can anyone capture him by the eyes, or trap him and pierce his nose? Can you pull in the leviathan with a fish hook, or tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he keep begging you for mercy? Will he speak to you with gentle words? Will he make an agreement with you for you to take him as your slave for life? Can you make a pet of him like a bird, or put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders barter for him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his hide with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? If you lay a hand on him, you will remember the struggle and never do it again. Any hope of subduing him is false. The mere sight of him is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse him. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. I will not fail to speak of his limbs, his strength and his graceful form. Who can strip off his outer coat? Who would approach him with a bridle? Who dares open the doors of his mouth, ringed about with his fearsome teeth? His back has rows of shields tightly sealed together. Each is so close to the next that no air can pass between. They are joined fast to one another. They cling together and cannot be parted. His snorting throws out flashes of light. His eyes are like the rays of dawn. Firebrands stream from his mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from his nostrils as from a boiling pot over a fire of reeds. His breath sets coals ablaze, and flames dart from his mouth. Strength resides in his neck. Dismay goes before him. The folds of his flesh are tightly joined. They are firm and immovable. His chest is hard as rock, hard as a lower millstone. When he rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before his thrashing. The sword that reaches him has no effect, nor does the spear, or the dart, or the javelin. Iron he treats like straw, and bronze like rotten wood. Arrows do not make him flee. Slingstones are like chaff to him. A club seems to him but a piece of straw. He laughs at the rattling of the lance. His undersides are jagged potsherds, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. He makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron, and stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a glistening wake. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all that are haughty. He is king over all that are proud.
To verses 1 to 6. Just to verse 6. So let's read this together. Verse 1. Then Job replied to the Lord, "I know that you can all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge?' Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, 'Listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me.' My eyes have heard you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself, and repent in dust and ashes." Do you keep that open? Over.
I'd be very surprised if there were not some people here who have been coming to God recently, desperate for understanding. Their circumstances will have varied. You may have been suddenly bereaved. You may have been badly let down by someone you trusted. Or perhaps you had great plans that suddenly met an insurmountable barrier. Or maybe you're finding the Christian life hard at the moment. Maybe particular sins keep dogging you. Or friends or colleagues have turned against you because you speak up about your faith. And as you face these things, you are crying out to God for his help, asking him to make sense of your confusion. Well, if that's true, I think the book of Job has great encouragement for us. For that is exactly what Job does. Having lost his wealth, his livestock, his 10 children, and his health, he turns to God in his anguish, pleading for understanding. And as we started to see last week, his cry is the cry of real faith, and God commends him for it. This cry of faith comes across in some of the most remarkable poetry in the whole book. I think we should look at one example. If you turn back to chapter 23, page 527. Chapter 23, and I'm going to start reading at verse 3. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling, I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Would he oppose me with great power? No, he would not press charges against me. There an upright man could present his case before him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. But if I go east, he is not there. If I go west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. These aren't the words of an unbeliever. This is a man craving his relationship with God. Though he can't see a way through his suffering at the moment, he knows that God is sovereign. Though he can't understand why he should be suffering in such an extreme way, he knows that God is just. Despite the fact that his friends tell him he's being punished for his sin, he knows that they're wrong and that God will vindicate him. But when God will act, he doesn't know. And so he cries out. I think it's important that we recognize this point. It's a peculiarly Western notion that it is wrong to call out for help. We think it's somehow a sign of spiritual weakness, that it shows a lack of faith to tell God that you are desperate. But in fact, our thinking is upside down. Remember the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. It is the broken man who knows he is nothing who is accepted by God, whereas the strong spiritual man who looks down on him is condemned. We need to see that our position before God is always one of absolute need, and therefore we are right to turn to him in desperation. The Apostle Peter, when writing to Christians who are facing suffering, says, "Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." So if you're going through the mill at the moment, well, take it to God, because that is the mark of genuine faith. There is, however, a warning attached to this principle, because there's a difference between casting your anxieties on God and demanding answers from him. I wonder whether you've known that experience. Have you ever felt that God owes you an explanation or a solution? Now, why did God allow that to happen? Why did he take someone away from me? Why won't he change the thing that makes my life a misery? How long do I have to go on asking for help? Isn't it about time that God answered my prayer? Have you ever moved on from calling out for help to demanding it? Well, I think that we see Job reaching this point at the end of his last speech. Turn to chapter 31 and verse 35. Job says, "Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him account of my every step. Like a prince, I would approach him." "I've said enough," says Job. "It's about time that God spoke up. I'm ready to answer any accusation. I will happily front up to him. Let the Almighty answer me." And finally, God does answer him. After a young man called Elihu gives Job another speech, in which I think he hints at what is to follow, at long last, God's silence is broken. And he answers with the four chapters that we've already heard read this evening. Well, I wonder what you made of what you heard. What did you make of God's answer to Job's question? It's rather extraordinary, isn't it? Why does God start talking about goats and hawks and ostriches? And then two animals we've never heard of. And why is almost all of his answer put in the form of a question? It seems an odd way to answer Job's challenge. And yet answer him, it certainly does. For we find by the beginning of chapter 42, in the part we read together, that Job seems fully satisfied. He has no more to say. Well, I suspect that the way to understand God's answer is to get behind Job's challenge. Job thinks that he has a right to know the reason for his suffering. He thinks he can put God on the spot. Let the Almighty answer me, he says. And the essence of God's answer to him is this. Know your place. Know your place before the Almighty Creator. Look at chapter 38 and verse 2. This is how the Lord begins. Who is this who darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. I guess it's happened to most of us in one context or another. We ask someone something, and they say, well, let me ask you a question. And suddenly, you're on the back foot. Well, God here turns the tables on Job and puts him on the spot. And the issue over which Job is challenged is this. Who is the supreme authority in the universe? Who has the right to order the world as he sees fit? Who is qualified to answer questions about what is fair and what is not in the world? And God answers all these questions unequivocally by teaching Job two eternal truths. The first is this. The Lord alone has the knowledge. The Lord alone has the knowledge. Now, ever since David Attenborough first had his hair ruffled by a gorilla in Life on Earth, documentaries on the natural world have become almost universally popular. It's curiously engaging to see animals in their natural habitat and to marvel at the complexity of the world around us. Well, here, Job is shown perhaps the most comprehensive documentary there's ever been, encompassing the far reaches of the universe, the weather, the birds and the animals. Except he's not in the company of David Attenborough. He's in the company of the Creator himself. And as he's taken on this guided tour through creation, God asks him question after question, all of which enable Job both to see the limits of his own knowledge and the extent of God's. Show me your understanding, God says to Job. He starts with the basics. Verse 4. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Come on, Job. Surely you know. Verse 12. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? Verse 16. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Verse 19. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does the darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the path to their dwellings? Speak up, Job. Surely you know, for you are already born. You've lived so many years. And as the tour goes on, the questions continue thick and fast. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Can you rearrange the constellations of the stars? Can you give commands to the clouds and the lightning? Do you provide food for the lioness? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Did you give the wild donkey his habitat? Can you control a wild ox? Can you explain an animal like an ostrich? Did you give the horse its strength and its power? Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom? And see how he ends in chapter 40 and verse 2. Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. You might liken Job to a member of the public turning to the designer of a Formula One racing car and saying, well, I think you should lose the spoilers. They make the car look ugly. And God's response is like the designer giving him a 3-hour lecture on the physics and aerodynamics of the whole thing. Job, says God, you know nothing of the way that I have put together every detail of every element in the universe, and yet you presume to tell me how to run my world. Now, if you found the readings earlier somewhat overwhelming, I think actually that's quite an appropriate reaction. I suspect that we're supposed to be blown away by God's response. We're supposed to be left speechless, as Job is. Look at verses 3 to 5. He says, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." Job hasn't missed the point. There's no arguing with logic like this, is there? God alone did all these things. It is He who made everything and who sustains their every living moment. And if it is God's knowledge that stands behind the whole created order, then He alone is qualified to run Job's life and to decide what is best for him. So that's the first truth that Job has to grasp. God alone has the knowledge. The second is closely related. The Lord alone has the power. The Lord alone has the power. Though Job is starting to realize his mistake, God has more to say to him. Once again, he says, 40 verse 7, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." This time, his challenge is slightly different. He asks whether Job is strong enough to establish the justice that he's been crying out for in his speeches. I'll read you an example. There's no need to look it up. This is in chapter 24. Job says, "Why does the Almighty not set times for judgment? Why must those who know him look in vain for such days? The groans of the dying rise from the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out for help. But God charges no one with wrongdoing." Why doesn't God put the world right? Job asks. And God replies, chapter 40, verse 8, "Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's, and can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you." And this is fearful stuff, isn't it? Job comes to God and demands that justice be done. So God says, "Okay then, go ahead. Put everything right, Job. Let's see what you're made of. Finish off the wicked once and for all. And if you can, well then I guess you're right. You should run the departments of suffering and equity." Well, once again, the implication is clear. Only God is capable of establishing justice, because only He has the strength required for that job. And to illustrate his point, God draws Job's attention to the most powerful creatures in his creation, the behemoth and the leviathan. Now, we're not exactly sure what these things are. Your footnote suggests possibly the hippopotamus or elephant and the crocodile. It's hard to say. A lot of the language is very poetic. But that shouldn't stop us from understanding the point. God says to Job, well, first, look at the largest and most powerful animal on the earth, verse 18. "His bones are like tubes of bronze, his limbs like rods of iron. He ranks first among the works of God, yet his maker can approach him with a sword." Verse 24, "Can anyone capture him by the eyes, or trap him and pierce his nose?" Or says God, well, consider the fiercest beast in the sea. Chapter 41, "Can you pull in the leviathan with a fish hook, or tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Can you make a pet of him like a bird, or put him on a leash for your girls?" Verse 9, "Any hope of subduing him is false. The mere sight of him is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse him. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me." "Job," says God, "you don't even have the strength to subdue these creatures. So how can you stand against the God who made them? How can you presume to tell him how to order his world?" When it comes to addressing the great mysteries of life, such as suffering, There is only one who is qualified. The Lord alone has the necessary knowledge, and he alone has the power that is needed to put things right. And that means that we are in no position to dictate to God how or when he answers our prayers. No matter what we're facing, no matter how certain we are that we know what's best for us and how he should act, it is God alone who is qualified to take action. Take just one look at God's astonishing creation, as Job is forced to do, and it'll become crystal clear that only he has the wisdom and power to dictate how his world is run. Now, I think that two corresponding points follow on from that. First, it is precisely because he's like that, it is precisely because he has such wisdom and power that we are right to come to him with our anxieties, asking for his help, because surely he is the one who can help. Yet at the same time, it must be immensely foolish to come to such a God and to tell him what to do. What could be more dumb? How can we demand answers from God himself? Know your place, he says. There is only one king in God's world. Well, have you been telling God what he should be doing, I wonder? I think there's a lesson in the way that Job responds to God's revelation, and it's in the bit that we just read. Look at it again in chapter 42. He says, I know that you can do all things, and no plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now it's important to note, Job doesn't repent of the sin of which his friends had been accusing him, but he does repent of a wrong attitude to God. He assumed that he could call God to order and insist on his intervention. But now he has seen who God really is, and he is humbled before him. Now this may be a lesson that someone here has to learn at the moment. You may have been struggling for some time. Maybe you've reached the point where you just can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And you feel that God owes you an answer, that it's about time that he took some action. Well, God asks, who's got the wisdom and the power needed to run the world? You or me? Know your place before the Almighty Creator. And yet that's not entirely satisfactory, is it? Because it still begs the question, well, what am I supposed to do in the meanwhile? What is the Christian who is suffering supposed to do? Well, sure, I can cast all my anxieties on him, but if I can't tell him how he should answer, how do I keep going in the present? Well, that is our second big lesson. Know your place and trust your God. Trust your God. That is, no matter how bleak things look to you, you can trust him. Two reasons are given. The first is that he will sustain you. He will sustain you. Now, from looking at the end of Job, you might wonder at where we get that point from. Well, our problem is that by the time we get to the end of the book, we forget where we've come from. We forget that the whole book has been answering a question that was posed back in chapter 1. Does Job fear God for nothing? Does Job fear God for nothing? It is Satan who puts this accusation to God. He says that Job's faith doesn't count for anything because God has given him the ideal life. And so the issue is raised, well, does faith depend on blessing? Can God only gain himself faithful disciples if he bribes them with all of his good gifts? It is a challenge to the character of God himself, and therefore God allows events to unfold in order to vindicate his name. And that is exactly what we see happening. Although Job suffers more than I think we appreciate or can possibly imagine, he does not sin. He refuses to charge God with wrongdoing, and his faith does cling on. In his desperation, he may demand more than he should, but he never turns away from God. And I'm sure that this is meant to encourage us. The point is not, can your faith survive trouble as well as Job's did? But that the faith that God gives will survive trouble. That's the point that God is demonstrating, that faith is not merely self-interest. The faith that God gives is not dependent on a stream of blessings. It will survive even intense suffering. We find this hard to believe, but history testifies to its truth. Whenever the church is persecuted and we expect Christians to give up, in fact, true believers flourish. We heard last week, didn't we, about what happened in China. The missionaries were kicked out in 1947 as the country fell under an atheist regime. But 40 years later, when the missionaries went back in, the church had grown fivefold. And any of you who've read the book Killing Fields, Living Fields, which describes what happened to the church in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, will know that through the most terrible persecution, the church stood firm, even though the vast majority were killed for their faith. Now again, it seems remarkable to us, but that's because we think that we're not strong enough. But we miss the point that God is the strong one. He is strong in our weakness. The faith that God gives will survive. He will sustain us. As has been said, what we need is not great faith, but faith in a great God. So trust your God. First, he will sustain you. Second, he will reward you. He will reward you. Now, the book of Job has a happy ending. And having got this far, it would be a shame to miss the end of the book. So let's read the last few verses. Look at verse 12 of chapter 42. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Heron Hapuch. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance, along with their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation. And so he died, old and full of years. That last phrase, he died old and full of years, is an epitaph that is reserved for the very greatest of God's people in the Old Testament, Abraham and David. This really is a happy ending. Job is handsomely rewarded for his perseverance. But hold on a minute, you say. This can't mean that if I persevere through suffering, then I'm going to gain a vast fortune and have extremely good-looking kids. And you'd be right. But turn to James chapter 5 in the New Testament. This is page 1216. 1216. Right at the back of the Bible. James chapter 5. And verses 10 and 11. James says, "Brothers, as an example of patience in suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy." This New Testament interpretation tells us that Job is an example for us of patience in suffering. Well, what kind of patience is James referring to? Well, look back to verse 7. "Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming." There's no hint in James that the reward is here and now. Rather, Job is an example to us to be patient until Jesus returns, until heaven. Now, some people may cry, "Oh, well, I might have known that it would be something spiritual. You know, how about a bit of reward in this life?" But may I suggest that you hold your fire, because I think that we very much underestimate the riches of heaven compared with the things of this world. Think even of Job. Presumably, he eventually lost even all of the wealth that was restored to him, certainly ultimately when he died. Whereas our reward in heaven, well, if you look across the page, if you're still in James, to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4, Peter says that we have an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you. And look on to verse 5, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. So keep going. Your reward is certain, and the reward God has in store for you is absolutely secure in heaven. It can never be taken away. Now, obviously, I have no idea what anyone here may be facing at the moment. It may be that you feel as though you're barely hanging on to your faith. You may have no idea how things are going to work out. I really don't know. But I am certain that God has given us a great gift in the book of Job, because it gives us one or two fixed points onto which we can cling. And above all, it brings us face to face with a God who is big enough to take care of the things that we don't understand. A sovereign God who is in complete control of his world. And a God who has given us all we need to persevere when we can't see a way through. He is actively in control of all of his creation. He can certainly control your life as well. He will sustain you and he will reward you. You can trust your God.